A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's been turning over something from our life expectancy discussion, and he's landed on the part that actually got under his skin. The idea that retirement, this whole funded stretch of leisure between working and dying, is a fairly novel invention, and his reaction is personal. He says work and being productive are core to his identity, and being forced to stop at an arbitrary age would be torturous. He'd rather choose the kind of work he does than be pushed out. He also raises the talent pool argument, that retirement deprives workforces of longevity of experience that could complement younger workers' cutting-edge skills. But then he catches himself, because that framing is heavily biased toward knowledge work, where physical limitations matter less.
Right, and he's asking us to pull on all of it. Is retirement and pensions actually a novel construct? Before pensions existed, was the end of work tied to economic necessity? In pre-industrial societies, was it linked to physical decline below some threshold of meaningful contribution? And how have societies actually handled this? Because the modern setup feels so natural that we forget it had to be invented.
So let's start with the headline question, because the answer is yes, but with a distinction that does most of the work. Retirement as an economic institution, a pension, a funded period of non-work, is recent, roughly a 20th century construct. But retirement as a biological or social fact, slowing down, handing off, eventually dying, is ancient. Conflating those two is where the confusion lives.
The word itself is a giveaway. Retirement in the sense of withdrawing from public life or from one's occupation has older roots, but the modern sense, the life stage, the thing you enter at 65 with a watch and a cake, that co-evolved with industrialization and the welfare state. It didn't emerge from some natural human life cycle. What changed isn't that people stopped working. It's that stopping became funded, age-triggered, and socially normal.
And the funded part is the key. Before there were pensions, there was no wage to replace. The unit of production wasn't the individual worker. It was the household, the farm, the workshop. So when an elder slowed down, the unit absorbed the decline. That's the mechanism most people miss.
In an agrarian household, there's no retirement date. The older man stops plowing and starts mending tools. Then he stops mending and starts watching the grandchildren and advising on when to plant. The work tapers. It doesn't cliff. And the contribution threshold is much wider than modern waged employment allows. Childcare counts. Supervision counts. Knowledge transmission counts. The elder isn't earning a wage, but he's still contributing to the unit of production.
And think about what that actually looked like day to day. You wake up, you're 70 years old, your son is doing the heavy plowing now, but you're the one who knows that the North Field floods in a wet spring because you've seen it flood 40 times. You're the one who knows that the early frost comes in the third week of September, not the fourth, because you've been marking it since you were a boy. That knowledge doesn't show up on a balance sheet, but the household would be worse off without it.
And the knowledge transmission itself is a form of labor. Teaching a grandchild which mushrooms are safe, how to sharpen a scythe, when to rotate the livestock, that's not leisure, it's work. It's just not waged work. The modern framework has trouble seeing it because we've defined work so narrowly.
Which answers Daniel's economic necessity question in a way that might surprise him. Before pensions, the end of work was tied to economic necessity, but not in the binary sense we assume. It wasn't work full-time until you drop, then nothing. It was a gradual reallocation of labor within the household. The binary, working full-time, then not working at all, is the anomaly.
And that binary is an artifact of the industrial wage system. When production moves from the household to the factory, the unit of production becomes the individual worker. The wage stops when the worker stops. There's no household to absorb the decline, no lighter tasks to move into. The factory doesn't need a supervisor who can't stand for 12 hours. It needs a body at a machine. So the taper that had been natural for millennia suddenly had nowhere to go.
Imagine a weaver in a textile mill in Manchester in 1880. At home 50 years earlier, her grandmother would have spun at her own pace, slowed down when her hands ached, taken on more of the household management, taught the younger women the patterns. In the mill, there's no version of that. The machine sets the pace. You either keep up or you're out. The taper is gone.
And that's the moment when the cliff edge gets invented, not deliberately, but structurally. The factory didn't set out to create the cliff. It just created conditions where the taper was impossible. And then, decades later, the pension system came along and formalized the cliff. It gave the cliff a number and a date and a cake.
The craft guild is the intermediate case, and it's instructive. A master craftsman whose hands start to fail doesn't retire. He transitions to training apprentices. The guild absorbs the decline, and the contribution persists even when the wages don't. That's the pre-modern pattern in its purest form. Not a cliff edge, but a handoff.
And there's a lovely detail in the guild records, at least in some trades. The master who could no longer do the fine work would often become the one who inspected the finished pieces, the quality control. The guild recognized that the eye outlasts the hand. You might not be able to carve the joint anymore, but you can still see when it's been carved wrong. That's a role that only exists because the guild was flexible enough to create it.
And we shouldn't romanticize it. The taper was often precarious. If the harvest failed, the elder ate last. If the guild was struggling, the old master was a burden. The absence of a pension wasn't freedom, it was exposure. But the structure was different. The endpoint wasn't a date on a calendar. It was when capacity dropped below what the task required, and the task itself was flexible in a way modern employment isn't.
There's a phrase that comes up in some of the historical literature, the economy of makeshifts. That's how the pre-industrial poor survived, by cobbling together multiple sources of support. A little bit of work, a little bit of family help, a little bit of charity, a little bit of scavenging. The elder in that system wasn't retired, but they weren't fully employed either. They were in a gray zone that the modern binary can't even see.
Daniel's physical decline threshold question gets at this directly. In pre-industrial societies, yes, the end of full work was linked to physical decline. But meaningful contribution was a much wider band than modern employment allows. A woman who could no longer work the fields could still spin, weave, preserve food, manage the household, pass on knowledge. The modern framework narrows contribution to waged employment, which is why the cliff edge feels so sharp. Redefine contribution so narrowly that any decline in wage capacity looks like a fall off a cliff.
And there's the life expectancy thread we pulled earlier. When average life expectancy at birth was 30 or 40, most people never reached an age where retirement was even a question. The institution of retirement is partly a product of more people surviving long enough to need one. You can't have a retirement crisis if nobody survives to retire. The fact that we're even having this conversation is a demographic luxury.
Right. The problem is downstream of the success. We got good at keeping people alive, and then we had to figure out what to do with the extra decades. And the answer we landed on was this funded exit at an arbitrary age. Which brings us to the modern framework and its biases.
And let's be precise about the timing here, because it matters. The first modern pension schemes, Bismarck's Germany, the British old age pension, the American social security system, these all emerged in a specific window, late 19th century through the 1930s. And they emerged in response to a specific problem, industrial workers who were too old to work and had no family farm to fall back on. The safety net was gone and the state stepped in to replace it.
And the age they picked, 65, 60, 70, it wasn't derived from any study of human capacity. It was actuarial. Bismarck picked 70 because almost nobody lived that long, which made the scheme cheap. The ages were set low enough to be meaningful, high enough to be affordable. The biology was an afterthought.
The core problem is that the pension-funded retirement life stage assumes a clean exit at an arbitrary age, and that assumption fits knowledge work far better than physical labor. For a software engineer or an academic, capacity may hold or even peak late. For a roofer, a nurse, a miner, the body sets a real limit that no policy can wish away. So the framework is simultaneously too rigid for knowledge workers, who could keep contributing, and too harsh for physical workers, who often can't.
Daniel's talent pool argument is strongest exactly where he feels it, in knowledge work. Experience compounds there. A senior engineer who's seen three technology cycles can complement a junior who knows the latest framework. The complementarity is real, but the argument is itself knowledge word biased. In physical work, the complementarity is weaker and the body's decline isn't a policy artifact. You can't regulate a 60-year-old roofer's knees back into service.
And the roofer example is worth sitting with because it exposes the asymmetry. The 60-year-old roofer who's been on roofs for 40 years has knowledge that the 25-year-old doesn't. He knows which houses in the neighborhood have the bad flashing, which materials fail in this climate, which shortcuts cause leaks 5 years later. That knowledge is valuable, but it's only valuable if he can get on the roof to apply it. And if he can't, the knowledge has no carrier. The taper is blocked.
That's the tension Daniel flagged himself. His framing assumes the kind of work where you can choose to keep going, but the framework he's critiquing was built, in part, for the kind of work where you can't. The pension system emerged alongside industrial labor where the body wore out. The arbitrary age was a compromise, a single number that had to cover both the clerk and the coal miner.
The single number has always been a bad fit for both. The coal miner is being asked to work longer than his body can bear, and the clerk is being pushed out while his mind is still sharp. The number splits the difference and satisfies nobody. But it's administratively convenient, which is why it persists.
Which is why the knock-on effect matter. Age-triggered retirement creates a cultural expectation that older workers should exit. That shades into age discrimination in hiring. The experienced worker who wants to keep contributing gets filtered out before the interview. The institution meant to protect older workers may also be the thing that writes them off.
There's a study I remember from a few years back. Researchers sent out identical resumes with different ages, and the callback rates dropped sharply for the older applicants, even when the qualifications were identical. The resume said 58, and the phone didn't ring. The resume said 32, and suddenly the same experience was an asset. The age trigger doesn't just shape retirement. It shapes hiring, promotion, training. It shapes who gets a chance to keep contributing.
The health angle cuts both ways. The evidence on whether retirement accelerates cognitive and physical decline is contested, but the mechanism is plausible. Removing structured activity, social contact, and purpose can degrade capacity. That supports Daniel's intuition that enforced idleness is harmful. But it also means the just let people work longer prescription isn't costless. For someone whose body is already failing, more work isn't a gift, it's a sentence.
The research that gets cited in both directions is messy. Some studies find that retirement improves health, especially for people in physically demanding jobs. Others find that retirement accelerates decline, especially for people who are highly engaged in their work. The effect isn't uniform. It depends on the person, the job, the retirement, which suggests the binary itself is the problem. We're asking whether retirement is good or bad, when the real question is whether the exit is designed well or badly.
The modern framework is a blunt instrument. It solved a real problem, mass poverty in old age, by inventing a funded exit, but it did so with a cliff edge that fits some kinds of work and not others. The interesting question isn't retirement good or bad. It's why is the exit age triggered rather than capacity triggered or preference triggered, and who does that serve?
The age trigger serves administrators mostly. It's legible. You can write a rule that says 65, and the computer does the rest. Capacity and preference are fuzzy, contested, expensive to assess, so we defaulted to the number. But the number was never about biology. It was about actuarial convenience.
Think about what a capacity-triggered system would actually require. Someone would have to assess capacity for every worker, repeatedly. That's an administrative nightmare, and it's also a political one. Who decides that a given worker can't do the job anymore? What's the appeal process? What happens when the assessor gets it wrong? The age trigger avoids all of that by being simple and impersonal. It's not fair, but it's legible.
The state can see ages. It can record birth dates, calculate years, issue checks. It can't see capacity or preference. Those are interior states, and they vary person to person. So the system optimizes for what it can see, and the cliff edge is the result.
That's where the whole thing starts to feel less like a natural life cycle and more like a policy artifact. The cliff edge isn't something humans evolved to do. It's something we built, and we built it for reasons that had more to do with administration than with human flourishing.
The number was 60, actually, for the bus company where I worked.
60?
Regional bus company. I was an assistant to the pension fund administrator for 8 months. Man named Gerald. I read the paperwork of people who'd driven the same route for 30 years, and now they were being handed a number and a date. 60 years old, final salary calculation, out.
That's earlier than most schemes.
Bus drivers. The company argued it was safety. Reaction times. Gerald processed the claims. And the thing is, the paperwork didn't describe a cliff edge. It described a taper that the pension system then flattened. Drivers who wanted to go part-time were told it had reduced their final salary calculation. The pension was based on the last 3 years of full-time earnings. Go part-time before 60, and you'd be calculating from a smaller number. So they stayed full-time until the date, then stopped dead. The system didn't just assume a cliff edge, it manufactured one.
The pension formula did the work.
The formula made the taper punitive. A driver who went to 3 days a week at 58 was leaving money on the table every month for the rest of his life, so nobody did it. They drove full shifts until the day, then they were gone.
The abrupt exit wasn't biology, and it wasn't preference. It was arithmetic.
Gerald kept a drawer of letters from retirees who'd come back to the depot just to be around the buses, not to work, just to be there. Some of them wrote in. Gerald kept everyone. I've never forgotten that drawer.
They came back to the depot.
They'd stand by the fence and watch the buses come in, some of them for years. The letters said things like, I came by on Tuesday and saw the number 14 bus, and I remembered the route. Gerald read them all. He said it was the only part of the job that made sense.
What strikes me about that drawer is that it's evidence of a need the pension system never accounted for. The money was there, the exit was funded, but the identity wasn't. These men had been bus drivers for 30 years, and the system said, you're done, here's your number. But the identity didn't stop. It just had nowhere to go.
Because the taper that would have let them stay connected, part-time mentoring, a few shifts here and there, was financially irrational. The system punished the exact behavior that would have made the transition humane.
My brother-in-law drove a bus for a different company. He said the same thing. They made it impossible to slow down. You either drove full-time, or you didn't drive. He took the pension at 62 and was back at the depot within a month, just standing there. My sister said it was embarrassing. He said it was the only place he felt like himself.
That's the reframe. We've been talking about the cliff edge as if it's a natural feature of aging. But your paperwork shows it's an artifact of pension arithmetic. The final salary calculation, the part-time penalty, those are choices. Somebody designed them. And the design flattened the taper that humans had managed for millennia.
The agrarian elder who moved from plowing to mending to advising. That was a taper. The bus driver who wanted to go part-time but couldn't afford to. That's a cliff. Same human need, different institutional response.
Gerald said the drivers who came back were the ones who'd been good at the job. The ones who hated it, they took the pension and never looked back. The ones who loved it, they haunted the depot. He said you could tell within a week which kind man was.
The identity question Daniel raised, work is core to who we are, it's not abstract. It's men standing by a fence watching buses because that's where they know who they are.
That drawer of letters is going to stay with me. Because it suggests the cliff edge isn't a fact about aging. It's a fact about how we designed the exit. And if that's true, then the question isn't whether retirement is good or bad. It's whether we could design a taper instead of a cliff.
The bus company example shows that the taper isn't a technical impossibility. It's a choice. The company could have designed the pension formula to make part-time work neutral, to calculate the final salary on the best years regardless of hours, to allow a phased exit. They chose not to. The cliff was manufactured, and it could have been manufactured differently.
Which raises the open question, if the cliff edge is partly an artifact of pension arithmetic, what would a capacity-triggered or preference-triggered system look like? Would it be more humane? Or would it just shift the risk onto workers who can't afford to taper?
There's a real danger in the romantic version of the taper. The agrarian elder who slowed down had the household as a backstop. The bus driver who goes part-time at 58 has no backstop. If the pension formula is neutral, he's fine. But if the company changes the rules, or if the part-time work dries up, he's exposed. The taper without security is just precarity with extra steps.
Because the taper was precarious. The agrarian elder who slowed down had no guarantee of support. The pension, for all its flaws, solved that. The question is whether we can get the security without the cliff.
That question is going to get louder. As populations age and the ratio of workers to retirees shifts, the funded exit model faces arithmetic pressure of its own. The system that promised rest may not be able to afford rest at the scale we've promised it.
If the system can't afford the cliff, it's going to have to rediscover the taper. Not as a romantic return to some pre-industrial past, but as a practical necessity. The question is whether we can design it this time with the security that the pre-industrial taper lacked.
That's the design challenge, a taper with a floor, flexibility without exposure. The pension system gave us security with a cliff. The pre-industrial world gave us a taper without security. The thing we haven't tried is both.
The institution that promised rest may have also flattened a taper that humans had managed for millennia. Whether that's progress or a loss depends on what you think work is for.
Whether we can build something that gives people like Gerald's bus drivers a way to stay connected without standing by a fence.
Thanks to Hilbert Flumingtop for producing, and for the drawer of letters.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Email us at show@myweirdprompts.com. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.